Good afternoon. I will call this meeting of the House Housing Finance and Policy Committee to order, and we'll note a quorum is present. First up, we have approval of the minutes. I'll ask Representative Norris, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, Chair Howard, and I will move the minutes from the February 14th meeting.
Representative Norris moves the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Members, we have three bills up today. The first one is House File 831 with Representative Ryer, a former Housing Committee member, and so we're glad to have her back.
Thank you, Chair Howard and committee members. I am delighted to be back here in housing. It's really a treat. And I also appreciate the opportunity to present House File 831, a bill that will improve access to affordable rental housing for low-income pet owners. Pets are a huge part of many of our lives, bringing us unconditional love and companionship. For people experiencing housing instability or homelessness, their pet may be one of their important sources of support, maybe even their only family. At a time of statewide housing shortage and rising rents, House File 831 helps prevent homelessness and addresses housing instability by defining a reasonable pet policy for state-funded housing. More specifically, the bill applies to housing financed by the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency on or after January 1, 2024. All state and local ordinances related to pet maintenance or ownership still apply, including detailed prohibitions about dangerous or potentially dangerous dogs. Landlords or property managers may establish reasonable conditions for tenants, for example, nuisance behaviors, leashing requirements, and limits on the number of animals in the unit. However, landlords may not charge one-time non-refundable or monthly pet fees, nor may they place restrictions on the weight or breed of pet. This bill is important to supporting our housing continuum for people across the income spectrum. We know that some people become homeless or stay in unsafe situations because they don't want to be parted from their pet. And we know that affordable housing can be hard to find because of pet restrictions. This is also an equity issue, both in terms of patterns in the incidence of homelessness and housing instability, and some of the restrictions commonly placed upon pet ownership. Thank you again for hearing this bill, and thanks to the Humane Society of the United States for bringing it to me. As you may know, today is Humane Lobby Day, and I'm delighted that we have people in the room today who are eager to hear about this bill. And now I'd like to turn it over to testifiers who will speak more about this policy.
First up, we have Carrie D'Amato. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. First, I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to speak. Can you guys hear me okay? Okay. For the opportunity to speak on a very important issue in our community, which is housing insecurity and how it affects people in crisis and their family members, their pets. So animal welfare is a hugely emotional topic. We all know this. I find sometimes it's hard to distinguish between what we believe and what we know. Belief is based in emotion. Knowledge is based in fact. So today I will be talking about data and working with facts as how they relate to what I've experienced in the 4 years surrounding housing insecurity in pets. Again, my name is Carrie D'Amato. I'm executive director of Minnesota's oldest and first foster-based rescue, Pet Haven. Pet Haven is 70 years old and started in 1952. I've been with Pet Haven slightly under 4 years. Being that Pet Haven has been around 70 years, we've seen a lot of changes in the animal welfare landscape, but a lot has stayed the same. People and pets still need help, and that help that they need is now more than ever. So there is approximately 3.6 million people in the Twin Cities. Based on calculations derived from the Census Household Pulse Survey as of December 2022 for the seven Twin Cities counties, which is Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, and Washington County, there are an estimated 30,670 households at risk of eviction. A national study conducted by Maddie's Fund found 65% of households in Minnesota have pets, and the average pet-owning household is 2.2 pets per household. This would mean 43,856 pets were potentially at risk of homelessness in December of 2022 last year. It's an alarming number. At Pet Haven, this number doesn't surprise us. As part of our service to the community, we offer a crisis owner surrender program where people can apply to surrender their pet, their family member. Once approved to come into our care, we then place them in a loving foster home. This is not a temporary foster program, this is permanent surrender, and we work then to find a permanent home for them. This is never an easy decision for people to make. I personally process many of these surrenders, and I can tell you, many, many tears are shed, and gratitude is felt with lots of hugs for these people finding a safe place for their family member to land, their pet, their family. This program is extremely valuable as it not only helps people in crisis have peace of mind their family member will be taken care of, it also keeps pets out of our sheltering system, leaving space for strays and emergency situations. We have seen a dramatic uptick in the need of people to surrender pets. This increase is a direct result of housing insecurity. Many of these pets that come to us don't need to. Real quick, some data. In 2019, we had 286 surrender applications came in, and we were able to place 58 of them. In 2020, we had 972 applications come in. We were able to place 167. 2021, 1,695 surrender applications came in. We were able to place 233 pets. In 2022, 2,489 surrender applications came in. We were able to place 457 pets. So from 2019 to 2022, that's a total of 5,442 surrender applications. I like data. As you can see, I've got just a little bit more, so give me a second. So 43% of these applications were a direct result of housing insecurity. So from 2019 to 2022, that is 4,023 surrender applications as a direct result of housing insecurity. These are for all pets, for cats, for dogs, for all pets. Of that 423 applications, 21% of that loss of housing were currently homeless. That's 844 pets. 79% of that 4,023 applications were at risk of being homeless within the next 1 to 2 months. That's 3,178 pets, family members. 87% of our applications that were experiencing housing insecurity noted no longer can afford rent and cannot find a affordable housing that accepts pets. This was the answer of 3,501 people who applied to surrender their family member from 2019 to the end of 2022.
If you could conclude your comments in Ms. D'Amato. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. That's it?
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Up next, we have Shannon Glenn. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Howard and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Glenn, and I'm the executive director of My Pit Bull is Family, and I use she, her pronouns. Our mission is to keep families together by advocating for dog-inclusive rental and insurance policies, all while providing essential pet retention programming. Now, while I give this testimony, I want to recognize the privilege that I have of owning my own home in North Minneapolis for the last 6 years, where my two large pit bull mix type dogs that weigh both weigh over 70 pounds are likely snuggled up and storing with their 10-pound dog sister and my cat, who also thinks he's a dog. I recognize that home ownership is not an option for everyone, meaning that pet-friendly rentals without breed, size, or weight restrictions are extremely critical for pet-loving families. Now, in addition to running this organization, I have a professional background in human services with experience as a shelter advocate, a housing case manager, a shelter operations manager, and a business administrator. I have been a tireless advocate for those that don't, not only have pets, but those that are also experiencing housing instability, a lack of resources, and various obstacles to securing affordable housing in the state of Minnesota. I can tell you firsthand that searching for housing with someone with various barriers to housing on top of having pets can be a nearly impossible task. This is why it's so important for housing providers working with our most vulnerable populations to allow pets, regardless of breed or size. The companionship of a pet for someone who is experiencing and living through trauma can truly be life-saving. As you know, I'm here today in support of House File 831 on behalf of families who face discrimination every day. Our organization operates the nation's largest dog-inclusive rental database that showcases affordable and free-market apartments that accept all dogs, regardless of perceived breed or size. Our research has shown that there are over 25 types of dogs that are commonly discriminated against, in addition to lower weight restrictions that eliminate the opportunity for large breed dogs to live in rentals. Between 2018 and today, we have received over 4,000 emails from families desperate to find housing that accepts their entire family, including the family dog. 250 of those emails are those searching for housing just here in Minneapolis. Each day, families are faced with the tough choice of surrendering their family pet or struggling to find housing that will accept them with open arms. According to data from Minneapolis Animal Care and Control, housing and landlord issues are the top reasons for the owner surrenders, most frequently impacting families with large breed dogs. I believe that this bill is a start to ending discrimination against pet owners in the state of Minnesota. By doing this, families will have more options available to them when searching for a place to call home, specifically our lower income families and families of color. Of the 250 families that contacted us searching for housing help in Minnesota, the average max price for a rental they could afford was $1,150 per month, with many families searching for a rental that would accept their pets between $500 and $800 a month. Now, affordable housing is a whole nother testimony here, but want to do that as well. Our national rental research dashboard shows that there are a total of 293 rentals that we have collected on data on in the state of Minnesota, with the majority of listings in the Twin Cities area. 273 of those rentals have discriminatory pet policies, meaning that there are breed, weight, or size restrictions, and only 19 that are inclusive to all dogs. We also show that the average pet rent per month is about $40 per pet, and the average pet fees, including non-refundable deposits, is $258. Our support of this bill is to allow our most vulnerable populations to have equitable access to pet ownership and to reduce the number of relinquishments to local shelters and rescue organizations. We also operate the North Minneapolis Pet Resource Center program in the Weber Camden neighborhood, where we support roughly 100 families each week with pet food and supplies. Outside of the conversations about basic needs for their pets, housing instability is the second largest conversation that our volunteers have with community members and we attempt to address. The community members that we support through this program have an annual household income of less than $40,000, and nearly 75% of the community members we work with receive at least one public benefit. Now, I know that there's opposition to this bill, and the opposition is concerned about damage or nuisances that can be caused by pets while living in a rental. It's important to note that under the provisions of this bill, property management will still be permitted to regulate pet behavior and take steps to protect their residents from dangerous and ill-behaving animals and allow for situation-based pet policies to hold pet owners accountable for any damage caused. This common sense legislation will put the focus where it belongs, on the behavior of the individual and the pet and the responsibility of the owners. Another point that opposition has been concerned with is around pit bull type dogs. And now, being the executive director of My Pit Bulls Family, I would be doing a disservice if I didn't talk about pit bull type dogs. According to multiple peer-reviewed scientific studies, there is no correlation between breed and behavior. And quite frankly, this legislation is not specific for families with pit bull type dogs. But of course, families like mine will benefit from this legislation where breed and weight restrictions are removed in rental pit policies. On behalf of families across the state and the country who are searching for a place to call home with their family pet, I thank you for your time and consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Next, we have Julie Wall.
My first question, how many minutes do we get to talk?
3 minutes.
Okay. I was a little confused. So those went way over 3 minutes. So I did make my speech to 3 minutes.
Thank you, Ms. Wall.
Okay. My name is Julie Wall. I'm a landlord from Rochester, Minnesota. I oppose House File 831 for the safety of public housing. Would you impose this type of bill on private landlords to accept all dog breeds? You would get a big pushback if you did. I think the public housing landlords are an easy target because they are not well represented, as you can see at this meeting. I used to allow pets until the flea infestation. My tenant told me they had a flea problem from their cat. She had been bitten over 30 times by fleas. I did a bug bomb for the apartment, and I was in disbelief at what I was seeing. All the windows were black from dead fleas trying to escape through the window. One flea can produce 2,000 eggs in 3 months. Flea infestations can get out of hand really fast at apartment complexes. HSUS and ASPCA are unfairly blaming landlords for animals being surrendered to shelters. I did forward you a study from 2021 that the number one reason for returning dogs to shelters is behavior. Problem dogs do not belong at big apartment complexes. And then the next thing I would like to see, I would like to see evidence and numbers of the Minnesota public housing tenants who are turned away because of having a certain type of pet. This bill should not be considered without those numbers. I looked up HUD reasons for turning down tenants, and pet choice was not even there. It was, they listed four other reasons. I sent the link to that article. And HUD has no problem with landlords regulating pets by size or type. HUD has no problem with landlords charging a pet deposit. The safety of public housing tenants is going to be compromised by this bill. These high liability problems will occur with dogs at elevators, narrow hallways, and common areas, with dogs lunging at people and other dogs. And I hear those stories all the time. Dog bites will occur. I've heard lots of those occurring at apartment complexes. We will see more dog-on-dog fights in common areas. And then tenants also will let their dogs urinate and poop in the hallways and elevators. And I hear about this stuff happening all the time, too, and making the common areas unsanitary. How about the tenants who are allergic to pets? Landlords should be able to charge pet rent. There is way more work involved in keeping common areas clean from pet hair. We know there's going to be more urine, feces, and damage in common areas, meaning flooring replacement will happen more often. Dogs' urine ruins landscaping, and that will cost more to maintain. I would think that the tenants who are on rental assistance have a tight budget to follow. Pets are expensive to keep up with vet care, mandatory rabies shots every other year, flea prevention medicine, licensing, renter's insurance, and food. According to My Rover, the dog people, it costs the average pet owner between $1,000 to $4,000 a year to keep a pet. And I think this bill, the consequences of this bill will be that landlords will withdraw from the public housing market because of too much risk and liability, and it will hurt their livelihood. And as we know, there's already a shortage of public housing. Thank you. Oh, one more thing. And landlords can be liable for dog bites in common areas.
Thank you, Ms. Wall.
Sorry, I couldn't look at you. I had to read.
And I need to take care of a little business here that I should have before to get the bill properly before us. I will move that House File 831 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And also, Representative Ryer, you do have an A1 author's amendment that I will move. Could you briefly explain your A1 amendment?
I don't have it right in
front of me. Yes, but please introduce yourself for the committee.
Chair Howard, members of the committee, my name is Zach Eichten. I'm the Minnesota State Director for the Maine Society of the United States. The A1 amendment before you is a request from our friends at Legal Aid just to make sure that the bill is in proper order, that we're not accidentally saying that this wouldn't fall under the Americans with Disability Act or the Fair Housing Act. So this is just gets it in the shape that we would want to make sure that we're compliant with those existing laws.
Thank you. Any questions to the A1 amendment? If not, all those in favor of the A1, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Now the bill is before us, and I will open it up to questions for members. And I say Representative Meyer is on the list.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, Representative Ryer, for presenting this bill. I did have a chance to meet with Zach earlier, and he was very helpful. One question I had for you is, you know, what type of properties take financing from agencies?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. Based on my experience on the Housing Committee last session, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency funds a great deal of multifamily housing, primarily at lower income levels. I don't have this session's data at hand, but that's a great deal of the work. I think that the types of information that you would have been receiving from Commissioner Ho on the context of their work, that would be the scope of the business.
Okay.
Representative Myers?
Thank you. You know, and the reason I ask is just, you know, I'll have to go back and look as well, but, you know, having something like this, how many properties is this going to affect, you know, given what, you know, and Zach and I talked about this a little bit, you know, putting the priority to, you know, getting people that need housing and not putting in some potential roadblocks that would maybe limit one of the tools that we have to get people in housing.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Ryer, I understand the concept of this bill, and I think it's great for families to have pets when they can afford them. I do have a couple different questions. One dealing with the liability if something happens, should a pet do damage or injure, especially if they injure somebody. I see in the bill that doesn't, under the reasonable conditions allowed, it does say that the requiring liability is a condition that can be put in but does not have to be, depending on how things go with negotiations with probably have to negotiate with the tenants in the buildings at the time when they put these new rules in, because they're not in the current leases. But I'm not sure how that's going to work yet. It's not really described in the bill how to do that. But what I'm wondering, if there is no insurance, and in line 2.4 to 2.5, it says this section does not alter the rights and duties. The key word there is duties of the landlord with respect to preventing harm. So if one of these animals would injure somebody, whether it's in the common area, outside the building, or wherever, even in the apartment, would the housing provider have any liability issues?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I'm going to start with one part of this, your questions, and then turn it over to Mr. Eichten. To the first part, I think it's really important to note that this applies only to buildings that will be constructed starting 2024. So existing buildings that were funded by the MHFA are not included, so they don't have to retroactively work with tenants and figure those things out. And that was an important part of the bill because we didn't want to put people who had made investments in an awkward situation and have to renegotiate leases and so forth. Now to the rest of your questions.
Mr. Eichten?
Yes, thank you, Chair Howard, Representative Johnson. So what I would point to, yes, you brought up lines 2.4 through 2.5, but I would refer you back to under subdivision 2, the requirements to carry liability insurance. One thing that we really wanted to make sure when we were drafting this bill was that to leave enough flexibility for the developers and the landlords to be able to come up with the reasonable requirements that they wanted in their building. So when it comes to requiring liability insurance as a reasonable condition for a pet tenancy, we wanted to be able to give that flexibility if landlords wanted that, but we didn't want to overly prescribe anything. We want to make sure that we're working as partners to allow flexibility in different situations.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Ryer and the testifier. I guess I would consider tightening that up, because when lawsuits go, they always go after the deep pockets. So it's not alleviating the property or the housing provider from any liability with this bill. That needs to be changed dramatically to fix that. Also, I was actually had a great conversation during a Bible study this morning, and we ended up talking about this bill a little bit. In this bill, it doesn't allow for any one-time or monthly fees for the pet, because it says in 1.2 to 1.21, a one-time non-refundable or monthly fee for the ownership or maintenance of a common household pet is not a reasonable condition. Now, the conversation I had with Holly this morning, 4 years ago, her mother got rid of her pet cat. They've replaced the carpet, replaced the furniture, shampooed the carpets and cleaned the furniture many times. And the only allergy Holly's daughter has is to cats. It's been 4 years. She still cannot go to her grandmother's house, as a month ago when they finally did, after waiting another year, she had an allergic reaction again. And you'd be surprised how many people have allergies to cats. So I think it's something to need to look at, because to replace all the carpet and stuff in an apartment, and then you also have the issues with the common areas, that can be a lot of problem if they have a renter that has allergies. So I think we need to look at that as well and come up with a new solution to try to alleviate some of those issues. And then one other question on it, because the way this is written, it doesn't say new construction. It just says the agency will require each housing development that is financed receive grants or a loan. We've had housing developments that have received loans for renovation. So it doesn't say new construction. It's whenever there's new financing, it could be there. And I'm also wondering if a housing provider started allowing Section 8 housing, is that part of the financing, or is that would that not qualify under this bill?
Representative Breyer or Ms. Reichton.
Chair Howard, Representative Johnson, thanks. I'm going to try to answer all your questions, but if I miss one, feel free to let me know. So first, to the pet deposits, you're right, in the reasonable conditions allowed on line 1.20 through 1.21, we do say non-refundable pet deposits or monthly fees would not be a reasonable condition. However, refundable pet deposits, we would actually encourage developers to have those for all the reasons you listed about making sure that if there is any maintenance related to the pet, that you are able to have that. The reason why we want to be clear about non-refundable pet deposits is because of the type of housing that we're targeting. Because we're going for housing that's for low-income folks, that it's being developed by the Housing Finance Agency, that if the pet causes no damage, you're able to get that money back. Those are the types of folks that we want to make sure if there's any fees that are associated, you know, if they don't need to be imposed at the end of the lease, they're able to get that money back. And then up in subdivision one on the requirements, we are saying housing developments, so that wouldn't impact anything that's like emergency rental assistance or Section 8 vouchers or any other types of vouchers like that. This is for the construction acquisition of housing that would be targeted for folks with low incomes that happen to have pets.
Any further comments, Mr. Johnson?
Chair Howard, the testifiers, thank you for that explanation. I think we have to be careful because we have a huge shortage of rental units. We don't want to scare anybody off, so I think some things may need to be tightened up and worked on this yet as this goes forward. I'd prefer to do it in this committee to make sure make sure it's done correctly. But we have some concerns. I am all for pets. One thing I will say, my wife would be very happy that snakes aren't included in this.
Yeah. Chair Howard, yeah, the definition that we have for common household pets is from HUD definitions. So snakes are not included for HUD definitions either. So I'm glad, and I'm happy to work with you and your colleagues on language adjustments as we move forward. I understand the bill is being laid over. So thank you, Chair Howard.
A final word on the bill, Representative Breyer.
I'm sorry.
Any final words on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to say that I am a former snake owner. And I really did love Cornwallis, the corn snake. And he went to live with my son when we moved into a rental apartment that does allow pets. I want to say that I appreciate the conversation. I appreciate the feedback. That's how we improve our legislation and get good work done. So thank you for that. I also want to say that that's where the market is going. As a renter myself, I have seen the market rate market moving towards more and more opportunities and flexibility and openness to pets because, especially after the pandemic when there was the adoption wave, people are really taking animals into their homes and on the market side. And on the subsidized side, or the lower income side, I think we really need to be looking at that. I appreciate this bill, and thank you for hearing it.
Thank you, Representative Breyer. So I'll renew my motion that House File 831, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And with that, the bill is laid over. Next bill before us is House File 758. Representative Perez Vega. Representative Perez Vega, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair.
So moved. Present your bill.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this bill, HF 758, today, which will improve access to pet-friendly housing across the state. The bill before the committee today prohibits landlords from discriminating against potential renters based on their decision to not declaw or devocalize their pet. It also prohibits landlords from requiring current renters to declaw or devocalize their pets once occupying a residence. Housing insecurity remains one of the top reasons that pets are surrendered to shelters or rescues. Frequently, this is due to pet-friendly housing options being not so pet-friendly once you take a closer look. One of the most misguided requirements is requiring the permanent surgical alteration of a pet through declawing of cats and the devocalizations of dogs. Declawing is a painful procedure where the last bone in each toe of an animal is amputated in an attempt to remove the animal's nail. The equivalent in humans is cutting off your fingers at the last knuckle. Decline can cause nerve damage, phantom pain, pain from bone fragments left behind or arthritis, and pain-related behavior issues like biting and avoiding the litter box. Nobody wants a cat going potty outside the litter box. According to the National American Humane Society, for these reasons and more, there is a growing number of veterinarian organizations opposing decline. Devocalization, or debarking, is a procedure where the vocal cords of an animal are cut in an attempt to make the animal quieter. This procedure is painful for the animal and leads to destructive behavioral problems due to the animal's inability to use typical communication options. Luckily, this procedure is very rare, but the way our laws are written, technically, landlords in Minnesota could make that a requirement for dogs in a rental unit. As a renter, I can't imagine having to do this to my dog, Esco Mark Anthony, and the trauma it would cause to him and my family. My 7-pound miniature pincher's bark is used to communicate when he has to go outside to use the bathroom, to get treats for my toddler, or even alert that our delivery has arrived. His bark is controlled and is a part of our daily lives. Most importantly, even more of his voice being a gift to my family and to myself is the ability of Esco Mark Anthony being able to communicate when I need to get a sugar snack to level my insulin intake when my blood glucose as a type 1 diabetic may fall low. My miniature pincher's voice is a value in our family of renters. I'm grateful to have a landlord who supports families to have pets and encourage that if this is a problem for landlords with tenants who have loved dogs, then they as landlords should suggest tenants to enroll their four-legged family member to take a behavioral training class instead of a surgical procedure that would permanently affect their voice. Requiring decline or debarking as a condition of tenancy is an extreme response to a problem that hasn't been presented as the cat or dog hasn't even stepped into the apartment. The decision to do any major surgery such as decline or devocalizing a pet, your cat and your dog without a voice as a singer, I don't know how I take that, should be made with consultation with a licensed veterinarian and only due to medical necessity. Ellos tienen voces. Your pets have voices. Let them sing. Both of these procedures lead to long behavioral problems, which can leave a unit in far worse condition if we surgically change an animal. Ultimately, if we want to have pet-friendly rental units, we are increasingly sought after. The units need to be truly friendly to our pets. I ask members of the Housing Policy and Finance Committee to support HF 758. Gracias. And now, Mr. Chair, I'd like to invite our testifiers we have here today.
Thank you, Representative Perez Vega. I do have two testifiers on the list, Carrie D'Amato and Mr. Eichten. Mr. Eichten, you're already up there, so I can start with Mr. Eichten.
Perfect. Thank you, Chair Howard and members of the committee. As Representative Perez Vega already shared a little bit about the actual surgical procedures that happen, I'm not going to go into too much more detail. I just really want to highlight that the main concerns that we are trying to alleviate here is that the surgical procedures are frequently just a misguided attempt to make a unit more habitable for future tenants. But in reality, they actually lead to worse property later on because of the behavioral issues that these can cause. With declawing of cats, the main thing that we see is litter box avoidance or biting. Both things would be not great for the unit moving forward. And with devocalization or debarking, aggression and property damage are the main behavioral issues we see with dogs that have been devocalized. Both are worse for the unit in the long term, and they're both of these issues are remedied with either soft nail caps that you can get for your cats, or there's new technology around like collars that will like spray a little bit of water into a dog's face when they start barking. There are humane options that you can go along with, behavioral classes for animals. So with that, we would just appreciate your support moving forward on House File 758. We have one more testifier, but I'll be back here if you have any questions on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Up next, Carrie D'Amato. Mm-hmm. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. I promise to be much shorter this time. As you know, I'm Carrie D'Amato, director of Pet Haven, our oldest Minnesota rescue. as part of our surrender program, we do receive a lot of requests to surrender cats with behavioral issues. Of those cats, 87% of them have litter box issues, and that's why they're being surrendered. Of that percentage, about 83% of those are declawed cats. We see a lot of owners surrendering declawed cats because of litter box avoidance, and it is a real challenge. I myself have a cat that is declawed that came to me through rescue, and he has severe pain challenges, has to be on pain management because the cartilage and the bone growth continued to grow. We've tried to fix his feet multiple times, and now we just have to deal with pain management. The American Medical Veterinary Association does state that about 33% of cats that are declawed do suffer from some kind of behavioral issues as a result of pain and discomfort from declawing. So I'm just really asking for your support on this bill, as we do feel at Pet Haven that declawing is not only unnecessary, but it promotes suffering that is not needed. We have a no declaw policy with all of our adopters. They sign an agreement that they will not declaw. We also work with all of our vet partners to send out a message that this is our policy, and all of our vet partners follow this policy. Most that we work with feel that it's very important. So I just really thank you for your attention to this bill and hope that you consider it. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify on this bill? If not, we can go to member questions. Are there any member questions? Representative Johnson.
Chair Howard, I got a question. I missed where this bill is going from here.
This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay. The reason I'm asking is because in Subdivision 3 it's got civil penalties, it does need to go to judiciary. It's $1,000, a couple different places for $1,000 civil penalties, and that would require it to go to judiciary.
Representative Johnson, we can take a look at that.
Thank you.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Perez Vega, you got me here. I'm with you. Devocalizing and declawing is a stupid idea. And even though my two cats, Moose and Mowgli, scratch the crap out of me every now and then, that's just part of it. And our dog, Hazel, who is a pit bull chocolate lab mix, is not particularly fond of the UPS driver, but it just knows that I need to go outside and pick up the package. And I think that when we buy pets, we train them to handle that well, and that if you are a landlord and you're going to allow that rental, then you should just also expect that that's part of the game. So,
Representative Perez Vega, any final comments?
Yes, thank you, Chairman, and thank you, Representative Nash. I care about our four-legged cats and dogs a lot. I have a daughter who wishes she could bring all of them home, and I said that's not possible. We're not a zoo, but it's encouraging to hear that folks care about our animals. Our animals are our family members. Our animals are our friends, and our animals are our caretakers. I just can't imagine having to see and be the owner of a pet that can't be its full potential. I appreciate our testifiers here who have been supportive and strong and representing a large community of our animal lovers. And I also am grateful for folks in support of HF 758. With that, I just want to close out with a little of my dog's favorite song.
Oh, boy.
Thank you.
You left me speechless there, Representative Perez Vega. But I will renew my motion that House File 758 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, and the bill is laid over.
Gracias.
Up next is House File 1219, Representative Kozlowski. Do you have a soundtrack for this bill, Representative Kozlowski? Or?
I also have to say I am also not in Team Snake, and don't worry, I'm not a musician. So no music here.
All right, Representative Kozlowski, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
I would like to move my bill. Thank you.
So moved. Please present your bill.
All right. Well, hello, everybody. I am really excited to be here to present on a really important bill to myself, to our community, and one that I know is really critical to the state of Minnesota. And that is House File 1219 before the committee today, which would appropriate $3 million to the Home Ownership Education, Counseling, and Training Program, known as HECAT. The HECAT Fund supports affordable, sustainable home ownership throughout Minnesota. And HECAT is the primary source of funding for home ownership education and advising, as well as financial wellness and foreclosure prevention services in the state. Access to this independent education and advising, like that supported by HECAT, is one of the primary contributors to promoting home ownership, especially for communities of color and low-income families. The HECAT pool includes dollars from the state, the Home Ownership Center, Family Housing Fund, and Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. HECAT also leverages an additional approximately $1 million annually from federal government and private sources. This funding is granted to community-based agencies throughout a competitive process. HECAT recipients participate in a robust data sharing and program evaluation through the Home Ownership Center and Minnesota Housing. These community-based agencies provide financial coaching, home buyer education classes, one-on-one advising, and foreclosure prevention services. Some households also participate in a class and are ready to go. Others work with advisors for up to 2 years to get ready for home ownership. Lenders and real estate professionals alike recognize the value of these services provided by HECAT recipients. Most down payment assistance and affordable lending tools require services from these agencies. And before I move into providing testifiers, I just wanted to share that in terms of, you know, talking about pathways for home ownership, pathways for everybody to have a home in Minnesota, no matter if that's renting or home owning. But we know that home ownership is one of the surest ways to build and rebuild generational wealth. And I'm here today, and one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this funding is because I'm a first-gen home owner. And I was lucky enough to come through and purchase a home as a first-time buyer. You know, I earned my Master of Business Administration, and so having the skills and understanding to go through the process. But I know that every single day people in my community access, in your community and across the state, access these really important services. And, you know, in terms of what we're passing on to our kids and what we're building up is really monumental. So in my life, when my mom, I've talked here in this committee that my mom had experienced homelessness. And when she passed away facing homelessness, well, she passed on to us with a bill. It is expensive to die. And because now that I'm able to be a homeowner, like many people in our communities who are able to go through these programs, who are able to get down payment assistance, what we're passing on is a good life to our kids. We're passing on security to our kids and to our communities. And I've got to give a shout out to many of the folks in my community who provide these services, doing so with 2.5 staff. They tell me that out of 150 people that they're able to serve this past year, that 105 went on ultimately to be able to purchase a home, but that all 150 were able to walk away more informed, better educated, and empowered. So next, I'd like to move into my testifiers. My first testifier is Julie Guggen with the Home Ownership Center.
Ms. Guggen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Chair Howard and members of the committee, my name is Julie Guggen. I'm the president of the nonprofit Minnesota Home Ownership Center. The center believes that owning a home is a foundation for personal success. For close to 30 years, we've worked to educate potential home buyers on the complicated process of qualifying for a mortgage, affording down payment and closing costs, and transitioning to sustainable home ownership. We've carried out this work by partnering with more than 30 community-based organizations throughout the state, like Urban League, Twin Cities, Model Cities, One Roof, LSS, Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity, and Project for Pride and Living, and others to offer unbiased home buyer advisory services and our home stretch homeownership education curriculum. Because homeownership is the main way that households in this country create wealth, we focus our work towards those that have been traditionally left behind, households of color and lower income households. Last year, 60% of the households we serve statewide represented communities of color, and the median income of households served was just over $43,000. We supported upwards of 5,000 households throughout the state last year. And I think as the representative shared, reporting, and I think it's worth noting, that reporting is an important part of the HECAT program. One of the jobs of my organization is to ensure that any recipient of HECAT uses a very robust centralized reporting system to document not just client served and client results, but also qualitative and quantitative information about how they deliver their services and the success of their programs. They are closely monitored. HECAT funds the fundamental provision of homeownership classes, one-on-one advising, financial wellness coaching, foreclosure prevention, and reverse mortgage counseling. All services designed to support successful homeownership throughout a household's homeownership tenure. HECAT is also instrumental in advancing approaches to homeownership education and counseling that are culturally competent, designed specifically for communities of color, practices that include cohort models that build support among participants, education that acknowledges historic trauma and the racist practices that have deterred or prohibited ownership from BIPOC households, and outreach approaches specific for BIPOC communities. HECAT supports services in multiple languages, including Spanish, Somali, and Hmong. HECAT advances critical partnerships between community-based providers and lenders and real estate professionals. These industry professionals volunteer at classes and collaborate with homeownership advisors to advance products and methods of support for BIPOC buyers. HECAT services open doors for buyers. Most DPA and first-time homebuyer products require HECAT services. It's in this spirit that I'm here today to speak in support of House File 1219, as it would fund additional monies for homeownership assistance programs and allow this important work to be expanded and enhanced. Thank you to Representative Kozlowski for their support of this bill. Thank you all for your attention. I'd be happy to answer questions when the time is right.
Thank you. Up next, we have Henry Rucker, Coaching and Homeownership Manager with Project for Pride and Living.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me, Chair and Committee. My name is Henry Rucker. I'm the Financial Coaching and Homeownership Manager for Project for Pride and Living, also known as PPL. And just to kind of add on to what Julie talked about, I think, and as representative said, first-generation buyers is we need to educate them. A lot of people that are first-generation buyers are in the BIPOC community do not believe they can be homeowners. And it starts because if your grandparents never owned a house or if your parents never owned a house, you don't believe it's possible for you to own a house. The one thing that's lovely about HECAT is it gives people the opportunity to go into a network provider and have non-biased judgment of putting them on the right path to home ownership. Maybe from working with them one-on-one with credit, maybe working with them one-on-one is around savings, and also just really talking to them about the possibilities of being a homeowner. A lot of times people don't feel like they can be a homeowner. And I think the one thing about HECAT, it emphasizes the home stretch workshop. So it allows people to come in a non-biased way and then get information that may lead them to calling that nonprofit and saying, hey, I'd like to take that next step. I think having the access to a person that also looks like you in a nonprofit sector that's not there to judge you but is there to work with you also makes a difference as well. I asked you guys, how did you become a homeowner, right? I asked myself, how did I become a homeowner? If that path is clear for you, I think it's easy, but let's think about the people where the path is not clear for them. We want to make sure that that path is there for them. You all know we have one of the worst disparity gaps in the state of throughout the country when it comes to home ownership. I would also share that the net worth for a person of color that owns a house is zero. Right? How do we fix that? How do we make sure that people can come into the doors of a nonprofit such as PPL, Twin Cities Habitat, the Urban League, Model Cities, and say, hey, I think I wanted to achieve that goal? We're here also to talk about the rent, right? It's also sometimes cheaper for a person to buy a house than it is to actually pay your rent. How did they get to that path? I asked a lot of you today, when was the last time some of us did a budget? Right? These are things that we work with people in a one-on-one advising capacity. What is your credit score to buy a house? What is needed as far as a down payment? Julie mentioned a lot of people don't know that there are down payment assistance programs out there. If I don't know about those, how do I find out about them if I don't have a person in my family that's become a homeowner? We're talking about first generation. There's about 5,000 people that are in a position today that could be homeowners that don't have the idea that they could be a homeowner because it's never been introduced to them. We can do a lot more, and by expanding this work, we can get more people that are frontline workers that to help people to understand they can become homeowners, and that homeownership is a path. My daughter is 16 years old, and the thing I always think about, she's come home from the hospital to a house, but what about that 16-year-old child that's never come home and they've always been in a rental situation? How do we get them to see life different? And I think KECAT is a way to do that because we're educating their parents. So when they buy a house maybe at 44, that child understands, hey, I can buy that house instead of at 44, I can buy that house at 22. That makes a huge difference because, as we know, real estate is the number one way to pass on wealth in America, and we got to figure out ways to get more BIPOC people there to lower this gap and make sure that the next generation, the generation after that, has access to home ownership and also long-term wealth. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rucker. Next, we have Nafisa Osman, home ownership advisor with Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Howard and Representative Kozlowski, for the time to testify today in support of House File 1219. My name is Nafisa Osman, and I'm a homeownership advisor at Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. During my time at Habitat, I've had the wonderful opportunity to work with dozens of families and help them reach their goal of homeownership. I do direct client work and help clients reach their mortgage readiness by helping them with increasing their savings, increasing their credit, and reducing their DTI, as well as more things. Homeownership education is such a valuable resource for first-time and first-generation homebuyers. There are a multitude of reasons as to why homeownership education is important, but most important is to gain financial freedom. When you are educated, you are able to move through life with the correct resources to meet your goals. Homeownership education has allowed me to debunk many financial myths that clients have felt are accurate due to lack of knowledge. One example is that some clients believe that keeping a balance on your credit card is the best way to build your credit. With proper education, clients have learned that paying your balance in full and on time, as well as proper utilization of their credit card, is the most effective way to increase credit. With these knowledge pieces, they are able to build their financial stability, reach mortgage readiness, and ultimately get the joy of closing on their first home. Home ownership education is so important, especially for first-time and first-generation home buyers, and a resource that should be readily accessible for all. Thank you again for your time to speak on the value of homeownership education, counseling, and training, and I encourage you to support House File 1219 so more home buyers have access to critical education that ensures their success as well as their ability to build generational wealth for decades and more.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I will move to member discussion. And actually, I think there is an A1 amendment. Representative Johnson, is that your amendment that you'd like to offer?
Chair Howard, that is my amendment. I'd like to offer it.
Please proceed.
Okay, this amendment, basically what it says is these people, individuals that are going for the first-time home buyers, especially the first-generation home buyers, that they, since we're doing this program, it's a good program. Education is always good. And I want to make sure that the funds are being used properly. This amendment requires that if they're going to use this new state program that we're looking at putting into place with state funds, I believe, I can't remember the house, the file number that we had, that those individuals from those funds, that they would be required to take this educational course. Because I believe that it'll help them make a better decision whether to move forward, make sure that they know how to budget for things and plan for unexpected things that come with home ownership, give them an idea what's going on. And overall, I think it's a better program. It's going to make things work better. I remember back in the housing bubble, I was an unfortunate job of delivering eviction notices and serving them. Some I felt real sorry for. They were in hardship. And we were able at times to find out services to help them. But then we had the others. They hadn't paid their rent for six, or their mortgage for 6 months. And I look around, I see a brand new Escalade, three brand new snowmobiles, a couple ATVs, a new boat. They were making those payments while they were not making their house payment. So I think giving the education and the training they need to be a good homeowner and better understanding what the requirements are and the obligations of homeownership, I think it'd be a good thing if it was mandated and required, or not mandated, but required to access the state funds up for this program to go through that training program.
Representative Kozlowski, to the A1 amendment.
Right. Thank you, Chair Howard, and Representative Johnson for this amendment and for your thoughtfulness. I took it as a friendly amendment and in the spirit of we've obviously heard how powerful these counseling and education prep classes are really important and impactful. In talking with Minnesota Housing and our partners who administer the grant, I understand that there are actually five programs that are approved under the HECAP program. And in fact, that there's actually already a policy that if borrowers in the household are first-time home buyers, that at least one of them has to complete the home buyer education course before closing a home. I also want to add that there's a number of programs or entities that don't receive HECAT funding that also provide culturally specific and relevant courses, such as to our tribal nations. And so what I would like to do, because this bill is being laid over, is ask us to vote no. But I like Representative Ryer mentioned before, agree that being able to have these conversations strengthen it. I would like to make sure that before we make any policy changes and have unintended consequences with our partners like the tribal nations, that we vote no, but let's have a conversation and get us together. I want to make sure that we get the language right. And for example, there's a step up and startup program. And in the startup program with Minnesota Housing, the first time home buyers and folks who are low income are required to take this class, but then you could step up and then that could have a duplicative effect if they have to go through the course, you know, another time. So for just some of those nuanced reasons, I'd like to vote no on this, but let's keep working on the language.
And thank you, Mr. Kozlowski. I'll just add in general, I think the spirit of pairing education with down payment assistance makes a ton of sense. Mm-hmm. And especially if we're going to be looking at doing a significant infusion of first down payment assistance. That's why this bill, I think, makes a lot of sense, too. And we should think about them in tandem, which I think that's what this amendment seeks to do. And so just appreciate those comments. But Representative Johnson, any further comment on the amendment?
Well, I would just say I'd ask you to support it for the simple reason, if there is some issues, that we can work on it to remind us that we need to really look at it.
Any other discussion to the A1? If not, I will call the vote. All those in favor of the A1 say aye.
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 Opposed say no. No. The A1 is not adopted. Again, I think it sounds like that there's an opportunity for some continued conversation on this. To discussion on the bill. Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair Howard. I'm going to give a perspective from my experience to share this committee and this bill. As a refugee from Laos and Thailand, you know, home ownership is non-existent, right? You know, ownership of your housing property is non-existent. You know, we come from a culture that the concept of owning a home and mortgage and interest rates is really foreign. A FICO score doesn't exist in a country of Laos and Thailand. I was four when I came to this country, and the housing disparity and challenges and outcomes of families who don't have stable housing is very so true. I am a lucky refugee who happened to be sitting in the seat, and I am very, very lucky to be here. But it's because of those voucher programs, and it's because of programs like this. My parents purchased their first house because they went through a similar program like this, and that was how we were able to get into our first house. You know, so programs like this is very essential. The reason why I took up a career in the housing industry as a mortgage broker is because of the housing disparity, is because of the challenges of housing in my community and how it affected me as a refugee, as a student, and as an American. And so as a mortgage broker, the program you stated here where you said that there was 150 and 105 went on to buy homes. But let me tell you something. Those 45 that did not qualify today will come back. And they will come back and they will buy a home in the future. I know this because sometimes you're going to help people with education, housing, and stuff like that. They may not buy a house today, but you're priming them to be home buyers in the future, you know. And so any program, just like the program that Representative Anderson recommended and any other program that requires education for people to be able to access public dollars or down payment assistance or anything, I think should be coupled with this in tandem, like the chair, like Chair Howard mentioned, to ensure that, you know, once we get them into a house, that they stay there and that we can overcome generational, you know, poverty and access to secure housing. And so I just want to thank you for bringing this to the attention of this committee, and I will be voting yes, and thank you very much.
Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Rep. Kozlowski, for this bill. Rep. Cha took us to a memory lane, so I'm going to follow that path and also talk about, like, coming from a war-torn country and coming to this country for a second chance. You know, when you come to this country with nothing, the idea that you can purchase a home and become a homeowner is not even in your list of things. Mm-hmm. What's in front of you is that you're going to try to work hard and build something. So for many families, like, the idea of owning a home is far-fetched. And programs like this make that idea a reality, or at least bring it close to reality. So I'm very thankful that you brought this. I represent Minneapolis, and I sound like a broken record. Every time we talk about home ownership, I get a little emotional because people will stop me at, you know, at the line at Target and ask me about, how can I purchase a home? What can I do? Where can I get information? So we, as, you know, a leader in this state, and all of us are sitting here, I encourage us to, like, really help people remove barriers. There's too many barriers. I know some folks think that we don't have, our systems are not, you know, built strong enough that it doesn't have accountability. I say our systems have too many barriers. There's too many red tapes for people to access simple thing as, like, simple education to become a homeowner, or accessing, you know, down payment assistance, or, you know, accessing rental assistance. There's too many barriers. So I hope that we in this committee and every other committee will work on helping people help themselves, because once somebody becomes a homeowner, there is, you know, generational wealth. There's also stabilization of neighborhoods. And then if I talk about this at every committee, we can't talk about education, we can't talk about jobs, we can't talk about any other future. If people don't have homes and stabilized space to call home, nothing else in their life goes right. So thank you very much. And I am, you know, very happy that I'm in this space to support something like this, and to continue to make Minnesota great. Thank you.
Representative Nash.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kozlowski, or maybe to the author, or to the testifier. How many languages are you assisting people in? Because I'm guessing, I serve on the Council for Asian Pacific Islander Minnesotans, and I'm just wondering, are we covering all of the bases that we need to? Because I think that that's, I mean, if you're going to educate somebody that English is not their first language, we should probably step up and check the boxes. So what, how many are we talking about here? So if you would.
Representative Kozlowski or Ms. Guggen.
I'll just say thank you for Chair and Representative Nash. Thank you for that question. I know in my community we have, you know, Spanish and Hmong and German and Ojibwe languages, and we're doing a lot of work to be able to get languages translated or written, and having interpreters, but I'll actually turn that over to the testifier to answer a little bit more.
Ms. Guggen.
Chair Howard, Representative Nash, it's an excellent question. We've talked about Spanish, Somali, and Hmong. Those are pretty standard languages that services are available in. And then we do different nonprofit organizations or community-based organizations will build their bench strength for translation based on who's in their community. So we've also had services in Vietnamese and other African languages as well. So and there, one of the things that HECAT dollars can be used for is hiring translation services as well. So for those languages that aren't covered by staff or volunteers, we can hire those translation services.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question gets more detailed. I speak fluent German, and I speak a couple different dialects of it. Dialectical is also quite important, and I'm just wondering if those are the things that you're going down. Just because, again, if you're going to learn, well, for Representative Cha, a whole different concept of owning something, which I highly encourage and I think it's great, as mind-blowing as that is, it's best learned in a language that you are proficient in. So I just hope that if you wanted to follow up, that'd be great. Because I know that, you know, we talk about a lot of the Corinne folks, and that's very, very difficult for us to easily find somebody. So just want to make sure that we're properly resourcing this aspect. Because I do also think, in having spoken to you and others, that this program ultimately will lessen some of the burdens on the courts, because now we're not having to go through some of the legal proceedings. So if we can properly educate someone on how to be a good homeowner, that we're going to see a lot less of the engagements that we may elsewhere. So once again, I'm beating the drum on languages because I think it's important.
And I'll just chime in really quick and just say that in terms of the intersection of language justice as well as culturally appropriate and relevant is also very important. And so that to the point of the amendment and to the work of how these dollars are with the competitive process directed in partnership with culturally affirming programs is also very, very important. Because when, for me as a Mexican American and Ojibwe person, being able to go to a community member that understands that how we talk about wealth, what we talk about in a home and within our language, our culture, multi-generational, all of these aspects are really important in that mix of things. So thank you for the question.
Representative Chai, I saw you on this point. And
yes.
Yeah. Representative Chai.
I just want to add to Representative Nash what he said, and I want to also bring up this point, is that even though, for example, in my community, even though we speak Hmong, it doesn't mean that we actually read Hmong, right? So the literacy thing. And so when you're thinking about crafting, you know, informational messages, you should also consider having, like, videos instead of just written language, right? Because that's still a barrier for a lot of communities, that they speak the language, but they don't necessarily can read it. And so... And just one more comment about home ownership is that in my community, the Hmong community, we don't engage in civil engagement until we own a home, because we start paying taxes. And then we realize that we need to start voting. And so in my community, the Hmong community, you know, home ownership means we're going to be more civil engaged. We're going to vote. We're going to go to city council. And that is the genesis of my pathway to be sitting in the seat, was that, you know, it started with taxes. Thank you.
I don't see any other folks on the list. Representative Kozlowski, a final word on the bill.
All right. Well, in closing, again, I want to just say thank you for this conversation. We're going to continue the discussion. But suffice it to say, we know that the services that HECAT provide are critical to addressing not only the financial wellness aspect, but closing the racial home ownership gap, which is the second worst in the nation, as we've heard in this committee. To the point in the conversation that we were just having, I did just want to close with sharing a success story from this program from somebody from my community that was able to utilize these funds. And it's the Barnes family. They went through the Counseling the Homebuyer education over 2 years, and it truly was a team effort for them. Overcoming barriers to pay off debt and rehabbing student loan, they were able to, over the course of those 2 years, obtain a mortgage. And they reached out to thank and share a picture of the home that they purchased, and they went on to grow their family. So we know that these dollars are having a really real impact. And as a first-time home buyer, there's so many reasons how come we aren't buying homes, how come our folks are experiencing homelessness. But the bottom line is that we don't have to do any of this alone, and that's what we hear from home buyers. And with the investment from the state, with this ongoing and increased investment, means that home buyers and families and communities don't have to do it alone, and that we'll do it together with them and be there every step of the way. So I ask you for your support of this bill.
Thank you. Thank you to our testifiers, and thank you to Representative Kozlowski. With that, I'll renew the motion that House File 1219 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And with that, the bill is laid over. And with that, this committee is adjourned. Thank you.